Okay, thanks very much for sticking around to our talk. I imagine probably most of you are running out of steam. I think we are slightly as well. So today we're going to talk about whether or to what extent the internet's making us intellectually arrogant. And what gave us the idea for this talk was a particular paper by Matthew Fisher, Mario Gaudu and Frank Keel. So in this paper, what they argue is, on the basis of a range of experimental data, that, quote, searching the internet leads people to conflate information that can be found online with knowledge in the head, specifically by inclining us to conflate mere access to information for personal knowledge. So if this is true, it has important ramifications. So it means that if we're searching the internet a lot, then we probably think that we know a lot more than we actually do. But what we want to suggest is that the matter of whether they've shown what they think they've shown actually depends on a range of assumptions that don't just come from epistemology, but also from the philosophy of mind and cognitive science. So we're going to split the talk into three main parts. First of all, what we'll do is take a closer look at the Fisher et al. Results and try to show how, on the basis of recent work in virtue epistemology, the interpretation that Fisher and colleagues give of their data also supports this further thesis that searching the internet is conducive to the vice of intellectual arrogance. Second, what we'll do is argue that this arrogance interpretation of the data rests on a further commitment to cognitive internalism, and then we'll show how the data can be given a different interpretation through the lens of the hypothesis of extended cognition. And this is going to challenge the extent to which Fisher et al. Are entitled to insist that subjects are actually conflating access to knowledge for personal knowledge in the first place. And finally, in the last part of the talk, what we'll do is suggest how, against this background of using extended cognition instead of cognitive internalism, we've got reasons to think that when we search online, sometimes, depending on how we do it, we might actually foster, in certain circumstances, virtuous intellectual humility. So at the beginning of the Fisher paper, what they do is note two normal tendencies. So first of all, it's well documented that our self-assessments are often quite inflated, even when we're estimating how good we are at offering explanations in domains that are quite familiar to us. So we probably all think we're a little bit better than we actually are at explaining things in our specific disciplines. And the second tendency that they look at is that we're increasingly in the habit of outsourcing many of our cognitive tasks to the internet. So although we might store in our biomemory where we can find particular information, so the search engines that we might want to use and what search terms tend to work, we actually rely on the internet to store this information for us. So in combination, they think these two normal and well-supported tendencies might lead us to think that we know a lot more than we actually do. So at this point, you might be thinking, well, when we're using an external source like the internet, we're surely consciously aware of the fact that we're doing that. But Fisher et al. Suggests that the internet's reliable and almost immediate provision of huge amounts of expert information make it different from other sources, maybe older sources we used to use, and that these particular features, so the huge amounts of expert information and the fact that we can get it as quickly as we can, might make us lose track of our reliance on it, distorting how we view our own abilities. So yeah, more specifically, the thought is that even though we might be aware that we've acquired certain knowledge from the internet, we might nonetheless overestimate how much of the sum total of our knowledge is stored internally. And this gets us to the conflation hypothesis, which is that online searches lead to an illusion whereby externally accessible information is conflated with knowledge in the head. Now, in support of this conflation hypothesis, they draw from a wide range of experiments, and Adam and I are not psychologists, so we probably don't understand some of this data to the extent that some of you might, but we've attempted to offer a rough summary of what they've found here. So first of all, they've got a couple of experiments that show that searching for explanations on the internet increases your self-assessed ability to answer questions about a completely unrelated topic. And then they have this third experiment that shows that this result occurs even after we control for our time, for content, and for features of the search process. After that, they've got another three experiments, and they aim to show that this tendency that I've just mentioned doesn't come from general overconfidence, like you might think it does, or from a different understanding of the definition of internal knowledge, but instead it comes from a genuine misattribution of the sources of knowledge. Now, obviously, one interpretation of their data is that when we search, we just end up thinking that we have better access to knowledge. And because of this obvious interpretation, they take great pains to point out that their follow-up studies show that participants really do think that they have more individual knowledge, not just better access. And they posit that the illusion of knowledge, as they call it in these particular cases, comes from the act of searching itself, and that the increase in self-assessed knowledge generalises. So they show how it still holds over the popular and effective search engines that give us good results, and less popular and less effective ones too. And in fact, even when search results don't actually show relevant answers, or in some cases any answers to the search queries that you input. So against that background, what we want to show now is that this conflation thesis, we can then move from that to a further and potentially more philosophically worrying conclusion, which is specifically that online searching indirectly facilitates at least some kind of intellectual arrogance. So our thought is that searching may cause our intellectual self-conceptions, in particular the self-conceptions we have about the knowledge we're entitled to lay claim to be artificially inflated in a way that's conducive to vicious inferences about our entitlements and about where we stand in relation to other people. It is, after all, as we've put here, a short step from thinking that you know more than you actually do to acting in characteristically arrogant ways that reflect this kind of misconception. So why does this matter? Well, firstly, if online searching does foster intellectually vicious arrogance, and even if it does so in an indirect way, then provided an individual's intellectual worth is at least partly a matter of intellectual character traits along with knowledge base, then it looks like we've got some at least defeasible reason to pull back on the amount of online searching that we do, or at least to modify the way that we approach it. Also, we think that in light of the fact that cognitive outsourcing is ubiquitous, this is a concerning result not just where we work in epistemology, but also, say, in the philosophy of education, where plausible epistemic aims include the inculcation of intellectual character development. So the next thing that we have to do is just a little bit of ground clearing so that we can see how such an arrogance interpretation could be most plausibly stated in connection with the studies that we just mentioned. First of all, a quick caveat about this move from online searching and knowledge conflation to intellectual arrogance. We want to note that arrogance is plausibly not just or even necessarily just a matter of overestimation of your abilities or knowledge states. So from the simple fact that the conflation hypothesis trivially entails an overestimation of your own knowledge states, it wouldn't thereby follow trivially from the conflation hypothesis that online searching makes individuals more intellectually arrogant. That said, this propensity to overestimate your knowledge states can play, albeit indirectly, an important role in fostering intellectual arrogance. So in sum, really, the move from the conflation hypothesis to intellectual arrogance is best understood, at least we think, is an indirect move rather than a direct one. So the three leading characterizations of intellectual arrogance, at least as far as we know, are the entitlement model, self-delusion model, and the interpersonal model. Although, based on what we heard from Alessandra this morning, I think our characterization in two of her work is probably a little oversimplified. So first of all, the entitlement model, this comes from Robertson Wood, states that intellectual arrogance is a disposition to infer some illicit intellectual entitlement from a supposition of one's superiority and to think, act and feel on the basis of that claim. So consider, for example, the case they give of a college president who's got two doctorates and thinks that he's fit to pronounce on every possible faculty field that is under the heading of his university. And so on the entitlement model from Robertson Wood, his intellectual arrogance in this case, it doesn't actually come specifically from his overestimation of his ability, but more specifically from his inference from his high opinion of his abilities on the one hand to this claimed entitlement to behave in certain ways towards other people on the other hand. So secondly, on the self-delusion model, and I think this comes from Alessandra's paper, Calm Down, Dear, is that right? Intellectual arrogance is, as she puts it, bounded up with delusional wishful thinking. So in particular, by acquiring this frame of mind in which the mindness of a thought is taken to be a marker of its truth. So for example, on this model, the intellectual arrogance of presuming all things equal that your opinion should be given special weight in comparison to another's is explained by you mistakenly taking in this mindness of your thought as indicating a lot more than it actually does about whether the belief is true. And finally, on the interpersonal model of intellectual arrogance from Tiberius and Walker, intellectual arrogance involves a high opinion of your intellectual worth, on the basis of which you then infer a comparative intellectual superiority over others. As with the entitlement model, the first one that we looked at, this interpersonal model locates intellectual arrogance not in the beliefs that one has about one's aptitude, but in the inferences that one's then disposed to draw from such beliefs. The entitlement model, the first one, is neutral with respect to the interpersonal character of the vice of intellectual arrogance, so some people would infer entitlements to behave towards others in certain ways and others might not. But in contrast, Tiberius and Walker's interpersonal model takes a crucial feature of intellectual arrogance to be the comparative attitudes that you infer about yourself in relation to other people, and about how this manifests in hierarchical and non-reciprocal relationships with other people. So although there are some interesting individual differences between these views, notice that all three accounts that we've looked at of intellectual arrogance involve at least some kind of high opinion of your own intellectual status, where high can be understood along the lines of above the mean or meriting intellectual praise. Now, such a high self-intellectual opinion, which is, I think, precluded by most accounts of intellectual humility, so for example, Church and Samuelson's, is thus a crucial enabling condition of intellectual arrogance on all three of the accounts that we just looked at. This is so, first of all, on the entitlement and interpersonal accounts, because it is from such a high opinion of your own intellectual merit that you might, if you're intellectually arrogant, make vicious inferences about what you're entitled to on the entitlement model, or how you compare to other people on the interpersonal model. And this is also the case on the self-delusion model, because this type of self-directed opinion underscores your appraisal of the epistemic status of your beliefs. So if we put this all together, if Fisher et al. Are right that searching the internet causes us to systematically overestimate how much we know and can rightly claim for ourselves, then doing so is conducive to increased estimates of your own personal intellectual worth, exactly of the sort of increase that is a crucial element of intellectual arrogance, at least according to the three models that we just looked at. And on the face of it, this is a concern and a consideration that militates against online searching, at least from a perspective where what we care about is our intellectual character. At this point, you might be thinking about two salient responses that we could take. So first of all, we could contest the empirical data, we could look at the studies and try to find an alternative way of interpreting the information. That's not our strong suit, so we won't be doing that. Second, we could accept the empirical data, but then try and argue that the intellectual benefits of online searching outweigh these negative effects that online searching might have on intellectual character, at least in such a way as to offset any reason that we might have to pull back on online searching or approach it in a different way. What we're going to do, though, is opt for a third strategy that's going to focus on the hypothesis of extended cognition that comes from Clark and Chalmers, and I'll let Adam tell you a bit about that.
Thanks. Right, so while we think that there's nothing wrong necessarily with accepting the descriptive component of Fisher et al.'s results, we think that there is scope to view the philosophical significance of these results through a very different lens. And the different lens is the lens through which they're viewing them, which is a background assumption about the boundaries of the mind. So this is, it's hard to blame them because it's the orthodox way to think about the boundaries of the mind. But it's a position called cognitive internalism. So this is going on in the background of Fisher et al.'s thinking. According to this thesis, an individual's mind is basically in their head. Put more carefully, the idea is that the material realizers of bona fide cognitive processes, such as memory, inference, introspection, and such, are exclusively intracranial processes, which means that whatever these processes are, the whole thing plays out inside the skin and skull. So if cognitive internalism is true, then this implies that memory knowledge, knowledge that one has in virtue of what one remembers, is going to be internal knowledge. It's going to supervene on states that go on inside the head. By memory knowledge, I'll put it this way. So right now, a few minutes ago, all of you knew that Paris was the capital of France. And you weren't thinking about that. But we would attribute knowledge because you've done something good, which is you have that content stored in your bio memory. And so it's what epistemologists would call it, it's a dispositional belief. It's such that were you to reflect on that content, you would affirm it. And so we'll say that you know that. If cognitive internalism is true, then all memory knowledge, all knowledge that's like that, is knowledge you have because it's stored in here, not stored somewhere else. it can't be that you have memory knowledge if cognitive internalism is true, if the content is stored outside the skull. So put more carefully, if this view is right, then the following is true. For any individual S, an item of information I, if I is stored outside but not inside the head, then no matter what else is true about S's access to I, S is going to lack memory knowledge of I. And if I happens to be really easily accessible to S, then the very best thing we could say, if cognitive internalism is true, well, that person really does know how to find I. But S can't possibly know I despite such access given where I is stored. That would be the thinking that would be implied by cognitive internalism. Now, Fisher et al. Take this internalist perspective for granted. After all, their conflation hypothesis presupposes it. If the view were not already in hand, then it should be an entirely open question whether or not one is conflating access to knowledge with personal knowledge. But from their perspective, it isn't an open question. These two are fundamentally different. So what is the alternative to cognitive internalism? Why would anyone reject that? Well, here's one popular way of rejecting it that's been especially popular in about the last 20 years, but it continues to get more popular. It's called extended cognition. Now, obviously, you might think initially that anything that involves rejecting the idea that the mind is in the head might be just scary or weird. It might be like the idea of thoughts or brain oozing out of the head or something like that. But it's not, in fact, that terrifying a view, and there's a way to state it in a relatively harmless way. So let's take an analogy between a very normal person. Suppose Inga, this is an example, by the way, that's used in Clark and Chalmers' famous paper, The Extended Mind. Suppose Inga has a normally functioning biological memory. When she learns new information, she stores it in her biological memory. And when she needs old information, she looks to her biological memory, and everything is perfectly normal. Now let's just compare her with Otto, who suffers, suppose, from Alzheimer's disease, and like many Alzheimer's patients, he relies on information in the environment to help structure his life. So suppose that Otto, we're thinking of him as an enlightened Alzheimer's patient such that he is aware that he is developing Alzheimer's, and so is attempting to compensate for this by carrying around a notebook, realizing that biomemory is becoming increasingly unreliable. So Otto, suppose, carries around a notebook, and everywhere he goes, when he learns new information, he writes it down on the notebook. When he needs old information, he looks up in the notebook. And for Otto, let's suppose that the notebook is playing the same functional role vis-a-vis memory storage and retrieval as biomemory is for Inga. Now, what should we say about Otto? One thing is, well, that's great for him that he's carrying around his notebook. Obviously, his memories aren't in his notebook because those could only be in the head. That would be one thing we could say. But Clark and Chalmers, and in particular Clark in his work after the Extended Mind paper, says, well, that's just bio-prejudice, if that's what you want to say. That's giving unprincipled due weight to things like material constitution and location when trying to determine the bounds of memory. Why not think about cognitive processes in a more egalitarian spirit? So they purport that when determining what could be the material realizer of a cognitive process, we shouldn't just ask, okay, where is it? Is it in there? And what's it made of? Is it made of brain? Rather, we should be guided by the ecumenical parity principle, according to which, if as we confront some task, a part of the world functions as a process which were to go on in the head, we'd have no hesitation in accepting it as part of a cognitive process. Well, then that part of the world is part of a cognitive process. And obviously, as we just noted for Otto, the process of memory storage and retrieval that he's using with the notebook seems to be such that work going on in the head, since it's playing the same functional role as biomemory for him, we would call it a cognitive process. So why not call such things cognitive processes? Now, it's difficult to determine, well, what is it in virtue of which something counts as playing the same functional role as biomemory? Is the notebook really doing that? Well, Clark adds a few extra conditions, and he thinks that these are kind of, I mean, it's depending on how you read it, maybe he thinks these are extensionally equivalent to the parity principle. But his thinking is that, okay, our biomemory isn't something that we just like take with us every now and then. It's always with us. And we don't stop and scrutinize our biomemory anytime we want to retrieve something from it. We don't trust it, we don't look at it as though it's a stranger and ask, should I trust that? We just take it for granted. It's sort of transparent. We don't stop and investigate it. Just automatically we endorse the content from biomemory. And so if The notebook is going to play the same functional role with respect to information storage and retrieval. It has to be playing the same type of role as biomemory along these dimensions. So here are some trust and glue conditions that Clark uses that are meant to distinguish genuine cases of extending memory through an external artifact from fake cases of extending an external memory through incorporating external artifacts, such as like hauling around a phone book every now and then. So one is, first condition is that the resource has to be readily available and typically invoked. Biomemory is readily available. Also, any information that's retrieved should be more or less automatically endorsed. It shouldn't be subject to critical scrutiny, just as we don't subject biomemory to critical scrutiny. And also, that information contained in the resource has to be easily accessible as and when required. So that's one way of thinking about the conditions under which we could sort of bring in something in the outside world to be part of a cognitive process. And by part of, I mean literally one of the material realizers of a cognitive process. There's also another way to think about these conditions. Unfortunately, an internationally leading scholar on this point is with us here, Orestes Palermos. So Orestes's idea is that, well, there's another way to think about the conditions under which we should bring in something external to us into our mind, and we could make this point rather simply through feedback loops. The idea being that, okay, let's think about how Otto is interacting with the notebook. It's not like the notebook keeps asymmetrically causing stuff in Otto. Rather, there's a type of two-way causation between Otto and the notebook. Otto writes something down on the notebook. He then later consults it. That changes his behavior. He then always carries it with him again, then he changes it, then it changes him, and they sort of drive a memory process along the way Otto's interacting with the notebook. And if I've got any of that wrong, Orestes, you can say that in the Q&A. So we might say, okay, so maybe that's true. Maybe cognition extends beyond the bounds of skin and skull to the extent that a cognitive process can crisscross the boundaries of brain, body, and world. But Fisher et al.'s thesis is about extended knowledge. It's not just about extended cognition. So how do we get from a thesis about the metaphysics of mind to a result that would be epistemologically significant about how we could potentially not only have extended memory, but actually extended memory knowledge? If we got to that thesis, that would be pretty interesting if that thesis were true with respect to Fisher et al.'s results, because they're presuming, again, that any memory knowledge has to be knowledge that's stored right here. And indeed, the results might have a different type of philosophical significance if it turned out that it was possible that some knowledge is not just stored in the head, but also stored elsewhere. So how do I link these two? So philosopher at Edinburgh, Duncan Pritchard, was the first to propose a way to connect these ideas to give an account of how we could potentially know stuff that's not in our head. His idea is that, first off, satisfying the kind of integration conditions that are needed for extended cognition in order to count as cognitively integrating an external artifact into a cognitive process might well also suffice to satisfy at least one plausible version of a view of knowledge, virtue reliabilism. According to the particular formulation of virtue reliabilism that Pritchard has in mind, this is a thesis, by the way, for non-epistemologists, a thesis that says the conditions under which you count as knowing a proposition. The idea is one knows a proposition only if one's true belief is the product of a reliable belief-forming process which is appropriately integrated within the subject's cognitive character such that her cognitive success is to a significant degree creditable to her cognitive agency as opposed to creditable to something that is extra-agential. Virtue reliabilism has a virtue, which is that it can handle this type of case that other forms of reliabilism couldn't handle very well. So Keith Lehrer in 1990 has this case of Mr. True Tim. So imagine someone who has a thermometer stuck in their head and they don't realize it, and they go around and they just say it's 31 degrees or it's 24 degrees. And you say, well, how do you know that? I have no idea. And it's the thermometer causing them to be completely infallible about the ambient temperature. Now here's the question. Does Mr. True Tim know that it's 27 degrees when he's compulsed to say it's 27 degrees? He's completely reliable, but something seems a bit fishy. At least so the epistemological intuition goes. Even though Mr. True Temp's very reliable, there's a sense in which when Mr. True Temp is right, he can't really take credit for that. Seems like the attribution of the correctness of the belief seems to go to the thermometer, which is something that is not really integrated within his cognitive character or cognitive psychology. So virtue reliabilism has a good way of explaining that. As Pritchard notes, over time, as the thermometer, as we twist, make a little twist on the true temp case, over time, as the thermometer becomes more integrated, our epistemic intuitions change about the extent to which maybe true temp can take credit for being correct via the deliverance of the thermometer that's stuck in his head. As Pritchard thinks, provided true temp at some point can take a kind of cognitive ownership of the thermometer, to appreciate that it is the source of his beliefs, to understand, sort of calibrate it in the environment, recognize that it's generally reliable, our intuitions over time would be that as true temp starts to integrate this thermometer into his cognitive character, Mr. True Temp actually can know the deliverance of the thermometer, whereas perhaps he couldn't initially when he had no idea the source of its reliability or the fact that his beliefs are being formed by it, i.e. when it wasn't suitably integrated. So Pritchard thinks that Otto, our Alzheimer's patient, that he similarly integrates his notebook, or at least if he similarly integrates his notebook into his belief-forming process via maybe the trust and glue conditions and satisfies a similar kind of cognitive ownership condition, then Pritchard thinks, well, over time, what is, by the lights of extended cognition, an extended memory process can, just like Inga's biomemory, support knowledge. So that's the view that Pritchard invites us to take on board, that maybe Otto can have some knowledge that is stored in his notebook, provided he satisfies certain cognitive integration conditions. So that's one argument we see from Pritchard for how this could work. Orestes also has some related arguments that show how that phenomenon could work. So in short, the types of arguments that we've seen that would support classifying Otto as knowing extracranial information in his notebook, they're going to apply mutatis mutandis for our information stored in gadgets and on the web, provided, so it doesn't matter what the artifact is made of, but just provided that we interact with our gadgets in an analogously responsible and epistemically virtuous manner. So here's an extended cognition gloss on Fisher et al.'s results. Even if Fisher et al. Are right that the boundary between some personal and interpersonal knowledge is becoming increasingly blurred, at least some, not all, but at least some externally stored information plausibly will fall within the category of personal rather than interpersonal knowledge. And of course, some might just want to balk and say, but is it really personal knowledge? It seems so away from the person. Obviously, one form of that type of objection would be to say, well, that just sort of begs the question against the possibility of extended knowledge. But setting aside the question-begging reply to that type of objection, there actually are reasons to think that information that is stored outside of our brain is actually very important to us being the person that we are. Richard Heeresmink, a philosopher at Macquarie University in Australia, has got some interesting work that develops this idea. He's argued that the personal character of extended memory knowledge is actually crucial to personal identity. And he sums up the key thrust of his position as follows. On an extended and distributed approach to cognition, external information is under certain conditions constitutive of memory, as would be the case with an extended cognition gloss of the Otto case. And as Heeresmink says, on a narrative approach to personal identity, autobiographical memory is constitutive of our diachronic self. And external information can be constitutive of one's autobiographical memory, and thus part of one's diachronic self. So if Heeresmink is right, then part of what makes us ourselves over time is part of our memory that's stored outside the head. So in a sense, we could say with respect to Heeresmink's idea that some of this knowledge is personal indeed, even if it's not stored necessarily in our head. It's personal in the sense it actually is constitutive of the type of person that we are, or us being that particular person. So putting this all together, it looks as though there may be less conflation taking place. By the way, we're not suggesting that one knows everything on the internet by any stretch. Rather, a more qualified claim. There may be less conflation taking place in the studies reported by Fisher et al. Than they are assuming. This, of course, would depend crucially on factors that are not reported by the studies, including what's relevant for extending a cognitive process, which is the participants' causal histories of interaction with the devices in question, and we can expect that there will be room here for plenty of variability. Nonetheless, though, we think against the background openness to extended cognition, there's at least room to surmise at least some of these and perhaps a significant amount of information that Fisher et al. Are classifying as interpersonal may well fall into the category of personal. knowledge. Now, the idea, again, would be that against a background of extended knowledge, it would be an open question. We'd have to ask further questions about, okay, well, how have they interacted with the device in question? Only then do we get an answer for whether or not they have extended knowledge. So it's not an answer that is exclusively determined by just the fact that they store it in some external location. So furthermore, it's considerably less clear how on either of the models of... Furthermore, it's considerably less clear how on either of the models of intellectual arrogance, which take one's relation to others as essential to intellectual arrogance, that arrogance is actually cultivated by claiming extended knowledge. So consider that typically it's very common... it's common knowledge to interlocutors with online access that their interlocutors have access to the very same information as they do. So the relational attitudes of intellectual superiority of the sort that the entitlement and interpersonal models would take to be endemic to intellectual arrogance would thus seem to require a certain kind of intellectual differentiation that extended knowers, in virtue of mutually recognized common access, might be less inclined to claim. So, how are we doing on time? Okay, I have just a quick further bit. Just to throw a bit of humility in at the end. We want to suggest how, on our view, it's actually not only the case that extended interacting and storing our information and searching online could potentially not foster arrogance, as would be the case against a background commitment to cognitive intracranialism, but also it might actually help to foster virtuous intellectual humility. Now, that was the picture that I found. It's probably not the right one for intellectual humility. That is a scandal-ridden man. That is Anthony Weiner. Google him if you want to find out what he's done. But that face is probably better described as shame. So according to one of the prominent views of intellectual humility on the market, virtuous intellectual humility is at its core a matter of owning our own intellectual limitations, which is something that can be manifested by in behavior in various different ways, including a willingness to appropriately defer, according to Jason Baer, and also to a willingness to avail oneself to fact-checking. Now consider, we discussed this in our full paper, Ward's suggestion that internet users are inclined to treat the internet as a kind of all-knowing expert. Such observations, when paired with a cognitive internalist reading of Fisher et al.'s data, would threaten to enable the inculcation of intellectual arrogance, and that they are considerations that would facilitate conflating knowledge access to personal knowledge. However, interestingly, these very same features could potentially play a very different role against the kind of active cognitive externalist background that we were pointing to. So a propensity to treat the internet as an all-knowing expert and the fact that it reliably provides informative responses that are precisely the kinds of features which make extended knowers super ready fact checkers. Online access, appreciated in this way, could offer a dual role of facilitating extended knowledge, while at the same time making it easier for an individual's false claims to be verified by the very same mechanism type on which the original knowledge was claimed. And that's through easily quickly going to... I have to use that when my mom posts stuff on Facebook. She doesn't check her sources, so I snope attack what she posts. So we do not intend to submit that online access will outright cause intellectual humility, of course. But we think it's important to register how aspects of online searching that would tend to promote intellectual arrogance, if cognitive internalism is true, could actually militate in the opposite direction, potentially, within the framework of extended epistemology, specifically by facilitating ways in which we could own our own intellectual limitations.